Sunny ways, my friends, sunny ways.
I'm not your friend, buddy.
I'm not your buddy, guy.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast. As heard on 90.7 FM in LA, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the beautiful Oregon Central Coast, 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and, of course, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org. Streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, on Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, other fine affiliates in parts unknown, and Radio Sputnik, 5 days a week. This is your broadcast. Thank you for taking a break from watching the Star Wars trailer to join us this afternoon, this evening, whenever we are lucky enough to have you here. A big show ahead for you today because, frankly, it's a big day. So much has happened over the past 24 hours or more that, most of it is summed up, I think, in our Green News Report, which we'll have for you later with Desi Doyen, who will be joining us then, as she does now. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hey, I'm not your buddy, guy.
I know, I'm not your friend, buddy. this is
a South Park reference for all those people who may not know that.
Yeah, well, if they didn't know it, then the hell with them. I wasn't going to tell them, but you already did. We have in the Green News Report, we're calling it our sea change edition, because frankly, everything that we cover in today's Green News Report is kind of huge and a huge sea change from what has come prior. And surprisingly, pretty much all of it, encouragingly, is actually good news. I'm amazed, Des. You never bring us good news on the Green News Report.
That's not true.
And so,
I bring good news all the time. And yes, this is an exceptionally action-packed good news Green News Report.
So stay tuned for that. One of the things that we're going to talk about on the Green News Report is what happened in Canada on Monday night. Huge news, a huge election, tossing out the conservative prime minister who's served for 10 years. We'll get to all of that in a moment. Speaking of conservatives, Democratic presidential candidate Jim Webb running as an independent, running as a Democrat, a Republican previously, now a Democrat. There, got it sorted out. He's dropping out of the race. He may be running as an independent. We'll talk a little bit about that ahead. You can stay tuned for that. And more on the amazing and, frankly, amazingly embarrassing voter suppression that is being carried out by the Secretary of State of Kansas, who's doing it right out in the light of day. And for now, at least, seemingly getting away with it. But first, before all of that, big news out of Canada on Monday night. Now, for those of you in the U.S. unfamiliar, Canada is that section of the map that is just above the U.S. It used to be all covered in white snow, not so much anymore, but that's what Canada is, in case you U.S. listeners are unfamiliar with it. They had a big election last night, a big sea change, frankly, of an election. Now, unlike U.S. elections, Canada's are not held on a regular 2 or 4 year basis like ours, but rather, according to Canada's Constitution Act of 1867, once elected, Parliament can stay in office, barring an event triggering an election, for as many as 5 years. Now, three men were on the ballot for prime minister on Monday. Incumbent Stephen Harper of the Conservative Party. He has served about 10 years at this point. Justin Trudeau, son of the legendary Canadian prime minister Pierre Trudeau, who served for roughly 16 years. Justin Trudeau of the Liberal Party and Tom Mulcair of the New Democratic Party, which, as I understand it, is more liberal than the Liberal Party. The campaign season for Monday's election, 2015 election, was from beginning to end just 11 weeks long. Now, to us in the U.S., that seems either insanely brief or wonderfully so. But in Canada, it was the longest election season in modern history, and it came at a cost to the Canadian government, which funds elections publicly, imagine that, of approximately $128 million Canadian, or $98.5 million US for the entire election. Now, as I said, Stephen Harper had been in power for some 10 years, and he led the country far to the right over the past decade. Trudeau's Liberal Party victory may mean a new day for our neighbors to the north on all matter of things, but in particular to those of us following the Keystone XL pipeline fight and Canada's growing reliance on petrodollars generated from dirty tar sands oil projects in Alberta, etc. This all may mean a new day for Canada's energy outlook. Here to explain all of this to us is a born and raised Canadian, now living in D.C. I don't know how he got past the border fence. Have we built that border fence yet? Anyway, Alex Dukas is a senior campaigner at Oil Change International. His work focuses on ending international subsidies and public finance for fossil fuels and shifting public resources toward building a clean energy future, including access to clean energy for all. Imagine that. Alex Dukas, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
All right, great to have you here. And let's presume for the moment that you're talking to someone who is really interested in politics and elections and energy, but who lives in the U.S. and therefore has no idea what takes place anywhere else in the world on anything. With that in mind, let me start by also mentioning I'm a South Park fan, so I just want to confirm your mouth isn't actually unhinged and flop around like they show on that TV show, correct?
Only on weekends.
I see. Thank you, buddy. All right. with all of that, give me a quick overview on the issues and controversies in this campaign, and then I want to sort of narrow the focus to your specialty, energy. But I want to start with the broader picture, because some of these controversies in these your campaign sounded quite a lot like the U.S., to be frank. So I apologize in advance for that.
Well, I mean, blame Canada is another South Park reference, but I think in this case we can blame the United States a little bit for some of the controversies that we had to bear with during this, as you said, excruciatingly long for Canadians 11-week election campaign.
Right.
You know, one of the things where the Stephen Harper's Conservative Party sort of tore a page out of the GOP playbook was toward the end of the campaign. Really making the niqab, which is a Muslim head covering, sort of a central issue of his campaign, about ensuring that Canadians couldn't take the citizenship oath if they were wearing the niqab, and promising to try and make changes to that, trying to basically whip up the Canadian electorate into an xenophobic fervor, which didn't work out very well for him, thankfully. So it wasn't a very effective approach, but it certainly seemed to be inspired by some of the stuff that we hear south of the border.
Yes.
The other things that were really major controversies in the campaign, you know, earlier on there was expense controversy from one of the conservative senators appointed by Stephen Harper. It's not a huge amount of money, but a scandal that he was, claiming incorrectly hundreds of thousands of dollars in expenses. And so, you know, hence the niqab issue, helping to distract from that scandal, among many others. You know, the economy was stagnating as a result of plunging oil prices, which I think is something we should return to in this conversation, and I hope we will.
We will.
There was a very brief, probably too brief, conversation around the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is supported strongly by Mr. Harper, who's negotiating it. The New Democratic Party leader, Thomas Mulcair, you said they're sort of the social Democrats in Canada, left of the Liberal Party, which is more centrist, did not support the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, you know, they're sort of, I would say, somewhat qualified support from the Liberal Party of Canada. But substantive issues like that, unfortunately, got sidelined for much of the election campaign by conversations about the niqab and those types of things.
But going into this election, it looked to be pretty tight. And the thought was, well, even if the Liberals win, they won't win with a majority. Liberal Party ended up winning a huge majority, did they not?
They did. It's interesting because the New Democratic Party actually, for the first time in the history of Canada, formed the official opposition. They were sort of the second party during the last election. And they really had a rough time this time around. They lost a lot of seats, and the Liberal Party gained a ton of seats. And, a lot of people are attributing that in part to people getting out to say, you know, who toward the end of the campaign has the best shot of just getting rid of Stephen Harper, because Canadians were really tired of his brand of leadership.
So a lot of
people saw things going one way, and they thought they'd jump on the bandwagon to do whatever they could to get rid of Harper.
So it wasn't so much NDP, New Democratic Party, falling out of favor as it was the nation sort of rallying around which party is going to be able to win with the majority government.
Yeah, I think it was really more of a referendum on Stephen Harper's leadership than it was sort of a vote of confidence for either the Liberal Party or the New Democratic Party. But a lot of Canadians were just, it's been almost a decade of Stephen Harper being in power in some form or another in Canada. So it seems like Canadians, given the mandate that they gave to the Liberal Party, were ready for a change.
And does that explain the sort of wild swing? We saw the Liberal Party, which has been so strong in Canada for so long, slipped out of favor. It became the third party, the third largest party in, I think, 2013. And now 2 years later, it emerges to take control of the government. How did they pull that off? Was it a change in their policies, in the leadership of Justin Trudeau, or, as you say, just everyone is sick and tired of the Conservative Party and Stephen Harper?
Yeah, it's easy to oversimplify, so I'll try not to. But I think it's a confluence of all of those factors. Mm-hmm. But I do think the main thing really was that Canadians were ready to just have somebody else in charge. They were a little bit embarrassed by Stephen Harper's leadership, and they saw what was happening to Canada's stature in the world. And it's not the kind of Canada that they wanted to see. So I think Canadians voted for something they felt would give them a good shot at rebuilding, rebuilding the social fabric in Canada, and really having some leadership that would help Canadians feel proud of Canada returning to what it was prior to the Harper decade.
Well, I must say I'm very happy to see what happened last night, and you're right. I think they were right to be embarrassed because I've been making a whole lot of we do a Green News Report show twice a week, nationally syndicated. And over the past several years, we've been making fun of Canada a whole lot, surprisingly, thanks to Stephen Harper and his policies. Before we get into some of those, to the role of energy and in all of this and where it might go, you had mentioned that you're actually in Washington, D.C., and there was some controversy this year for the first time about folks like you being able to vote outside of the U.S. Is this another page that the Conservative Party in Canada has taken from U.S. elections?
Yeah, there were a couple of things that happened that it looked like the Conservatives in Canada were learning lessons around voter disenfranchisement from GOP politicians.
You're welcome.
South of the border. So thanks for that.
You're welcome.
There was the Fair Elections Act was passed by the government led by the Conservatives prior to the election. A lot of people took to calling it the Unfair Elections Act.
I was going
to
say, as soon as I hear the Conservative Party pass something called the Fair Elections Act, I'm already wondering how unfair it is. So,
yeah, they also changed the name of the Ministry of Defense to Ministry of Peace. Well, no, that didn't happen, but the Fair Elections Act was really the Unfair Elections Act from my perspective as well. I think a lot of commentators saw the efforts to increase voter ID requirements, et cetera, as being aimed at disenfranchising a number of voters that may not be the most supportive cohort of the Conservative Party.
And the bill also made it more difficult for folks outside of the U.S. to be able to vote absentee? Outside of Canada.
There was legislation that would preclude Canadian citizens who'd been residing outside of Canada for more than 5 years from voting. And that took effect in time for the election. So the first time that Canadians who are citizens of Canada who've been outside of living outside of Canada for more than 5 years were not able to vote. And that's something that's yet to be tested at the highest levels of the judiciary in Canada. So it may be overturned by the time the next election rolls around, because in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is a foundational document in Canada in terms of governance, it guarantees the right to vote for every Canadian citizen. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out in the next several years.
And it was seen as an attempt to suppress the vote, essentially, pulled off by the Conservative Party.
I think many people viewed it that way, absolutely.
All right, so to your specialty and my particular interest here, what role did energy and the tar sands oil, the Harper government's reliance on a fossil fuel economy, et cetera, play in this election as you see it?
Yeah, well, Stephen Harper really ran on his economic record in this election. He really made the entire election, from his perspective, he tried to frame it around the economy. And can you trust the Liberals? Can you trust the New Democrats? Can you trust the Green Party? Can you trust these people with the economy? And you need a steady hand on the tiller. Unfortunately for him, his record doesn't really back up the rhetoric. Because, you know, Canada's economy shrunk in the first two quarters of 2015 heading into the election, which made it slide into a technical recession, you know, partly as a result of the knock-on effects of a low oil price environment, because Canada's a significant producer of oil and gas, of course. You know, I think that speaks to the fact that Canada's sort of sliding back into recession now, in contrast to a lot of other G7 economies, is partly a result of the knock-on effects of that low oil price. You know, his nearly single-minded promotion of Canada's oil and gas industry at the expense of other sectors certainly has contributed to the current economic malaise that Canada finds itself in the middle of. Because with oil and gas and commodities like them, you can always expect there to be a boom and bust cycle. You just don't necessarily know when the boom's going to come and when the bust is going to come. And, you know, instead of betting on a future, the future by investing in clean energy, Harper really bet the farm on oil and gas in his policy approach, and he lost that bet. And unfortunately, that bad bet is now hurting a lot of Canadians. So, you know, hopefully with a new government in power, we'll start to see that turn around a little bit. We'll start to see recognition of the value of economic diversification and a recognition that, you know, oil and gas is not the future for Canada, but that clean energy is really a huge opportunity for Canadians and one that the government can help realize to the benefit of all Canadians.
Alex Zukas, you referenced that boom and bust cycle for oil and oil prices. Alberta Premier Rachel Notley, who's a member of NDP, New Democratic Party, had already signaled, we covered this on Green News Report some weeks ago, that she believed that the nation needed to move away from reliance on fossil fuels. That was no small thing, it seemed at the time, for a premier in Alberta, home of the dirty tar sands oil fields, not to mention an historically very conservative province, as I understand it. Should her statements on that issue some weeks ago have given us some idea where Canada was headed as a whole? I thought it was an extraordinary statement at the time when she said, "Hey, we can't rely on fossil fuels. We need to move to a different type of economy." That seemed kind of huge at the time.
Yeah, and I think her statement was significant. I do think the language she used was that, you know, we needed to phase out fossil fuels within the next century. Which is not a terribly ambitious timeline, given the climate crisis that we're facing. And actually, Stephen Harper had already agreed to G7 language, although he did it, by all accounts, kicking and screaming, to decarbonize the global economy by the end of the century. So I don't know that we should be lauding Premier Notley too much for that, although I do think it's a good sign, especially coming from a premier of Alberta. But I think there's a long way to go. And I think, you know, Canadians and Albertans still have a long way to go with Premier Notley, and they can push her to offer more than that. But it's a good sign, it's a good start, and it shows that things are moving forward.
What does all of this mean now, then, for going forward for the tar sands and for climate policy itself in Canada? And then we can get to the most important thing, how all of this affects us down here in the U.S. But first, for Canada, how does it affect directly affect what we might expect from their energy policy and from their tar sands heavy fossil fuel policy?
Right, and I think we will touch on some things that may directly affect the U.S. here, because one of the big questions with the new leadership, with Pierre Trudeau of the Liberal Party as Prime Minister, is, you know, what are we likely to see in terms of their approach toward Canada's energy sector, towards the tar sands, towards climate policy, and towards pipelines? And what the official position ahead of the election was of Trudeau's Liberal Party was that they opposed the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. They had a sort of an unclear position on the Kinder Morgan pipeline. And sorry for those listeners who aren't familiar with all of these pipelines. They're different tar sands-related pipelines across Canada.
Right, all over the place, going north, south, east, west.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then a big web of pipelines all over the place. Prospective pipelines, I should say. I should emphasize the prospective. So they oppose Enbridge Northern Gateway, unclear about the Kinder Morgan pipeline. They support more or less the Energy East pipeline, and importantly, they also have voiced support for the Keystone XL pipeline. That's the one that listeners, I think, are most likely to be familiar with. And, you know, from my perspective, I know you said we'll get to the U.S. side of this. It would be pretty interesting for the Obama administration to reject Keystone XL now that the Canadian election's been decided. It's still, you know, that decision and that conversation is still something that's really associated with Stephen Harper's government, and I don't think it would strain relations with a new government if that decision were to be made soon. But the window of opportunity is closing. So I think you know, it's an interesting opportunity for the Obama administration to say, Harper's out, Keystone XL is out. But we'll have to wait and see.
So you're suggesting that this election now makes it easier for the Obama administration to say no at this point?
Oh, I think so. I think that, you know, I don't know how much, to what degree the fact that there was an election underway in Canada influenced their decision on whether to make a statement or not, a determination or not on Keystone XL. But I think now is an opportunity for them to come out and say, you know what, Stephen Harper's gone. This is his legacy, and we're rejecting it.
And it's
not going to tarnish relations with the new prime minister.
And so when Trudeau and the Liberals came out in support of Keystone XL pipeline, as I understand it, they said they were in favor of it, but that it should not be a point of contention between the two countries. So we can expect that if it is rejected by Obama, we won't see a lot of yelling and screaming, at least from the Liberal government up there.
Exactly. I think the new Liberal government and Trudeau are going to take Justin Trudeau is going to take no for an answer on Keystone XL. They realize that they have to work together with the U.S. and they do realize that we've been laboring under a decade of really terrible, reprehensible climate and energy policy in Canada. So we're going to have to start changing the way we do things.
Trudeau's campaign co-chair was forced to step down just last week after it was revealed that he had been advising his lobbying clients in the oil industry, specifically TransCanada, the owner of the KXL pipeline. He had been sending them email with advice in the midst of this campaign. And the emergence of the emails from this guy to TransCanada, that was a revelation, I guess. But his ties to the oil industry were well known, certainly by the party, certainly by Justin Trudeau, as I understand it. Does that tell us that perhaps Liberals and Justin Trudeau and the energy industry, TransCanada, Big Oil, et cetera, are more closely allied than people might think, or that environmentalists might like to hear?
Yeah, well, I definitely think that's an excellent demonstration of the fact that Canadians who care about climate change are going to have to keep pushing this government now that it's been elected, because it's not an open and shut question for them about, you know, the fact that we need to seriously address climate change and that we need to get serious about the tar sands and sort of extreme forms of dirty energy in Canada, because we didn't even have any kind of a clear commitment or clear target on emissions from the Liberal Party prior to the election. They were the only major party not to issue some kind of clear and unambiguous target for emissions. And so coming into Paris, the UN climate negotiations this December, where a big agreement is expected, it's going to be really important for them to provide clarity on that. And as you say, the party does seem a bit conflicted. So Canadians are going to have to push the Liberal Party. And I think it's really interesting, just mentioned for the listeners, that there is, you know, we do direct action in Canada as well. And there is from November 5th to 8th something called Climate Welcome, that's aimed at giving the Prime Minister a proper welcome. A series of serious but gentle civil disobedience actions is how it's described, which is a very Canadian way to describe something like this, to welcome Justin Trudeau to office and call on him to get to work on real climate action. So that's climatewelcome.ca for those who are interested.
Okay.
Hope you don't mind me plugging that.
No, not
but
at all.
I think we'll see what happens, and I think. I think it is, as you say, there's still an open question about how this government's going to be on the climate issue, and Canadians have a fantastic opportunity early on in the game to really push them.
And I want to ask you just a little bit more about Paris and that upcoming summit in a moment, but I got a couple of other questions that I want to hit. You're tremendously clarifying on this, Alex Dukas. Thank you very much. Speaking with Alex Dukas of Oil Change International. I want to make sure that we hit. I know that the First Nations, the Indigenous tribes in Canada, played a huge role in this fight against all of these web of pipelines you mentioned, and I think they need some recognition here for that in this fight against what the Harper government had been trying to see built. Can you tell us about the role that they played and the important role they played in actually blocking, stopping, delaying so many of these pipelines?
Yeah, well, certainly through direct action, through court challenges, through advocacy efforts, First Nations in Canada have really been at the forefront of resistance when it comes to the tar sands and when it comes to dirty energy projects that are going to exacerbate climate change and that are really, you know, destroying and hurting First Nations communities. So they deserve an enormous deal of credit for helping to delay some of the destructive energy projects that were developing under Stephen Harper's watch in Canada.
And basically, they were able to say, unlike what has happened here in the U.S., they were able to say, no, these are our lands. We retain this property, these property rights, and we do not want this pipeline coming through our lands and turning down the billions of dollars, I guess, that might have come with it. Is that what they were doing?
Yeah, absolutely. There are First Nations who've, you know, demonstrated an incredible amount of integrity in turning down significant offers of money from fossil fuel companies and refusing to cede their lands to fossil fuel development. And I think one thing that's important to note, though, is, you know, there still are a lot of cases where there is unceded land that's not under treaty in Canada that you know, where there are still questions around land tenure and First Nations control of those lands. And so it's you know, it's certainly even in those cases where there's not as clear sort of First Nations control of those lands, they've resisted and by and large. And I'm not trying to be essentialist. There are obviously a variety of views across different First Nations in Canada, but they have, as I said, been really at the forefront of resistance in a lot of the dirtiest energy projects, which is really incredible. They've really helped protect not only First Nations land but other Canadians from a lot of these projects. And one thing I just want to mention about the new government, Trudeau has also said, the new Prime Minister, that governments offer permits, this is a quote, governments offer permits, but only communities can grant permission. And so I think it'll be important to see whether he honors that statement, and it's especially pertinent when it comes to having a conversation, a nation-to-nation conversation between the Canadian government and First Nations on energy policy and planning.
In the minute or two we have left, I'm sure many in the environmental movement will say this election came not a moment too soon with those final negotiations that you referenced coming up in Paris in December for a worldwide UN climate treaty. What can the world expect this development? How can the world expect this development to change specifically Canada's commitment, or frankly lack thereof, under the Harper administration to emissions reductions and the fight against climate crisis overall? What was it that Canada was offering before, and what now seems realistic that they may be able to offer as we get to these negotiations this December? And I know you have no crystal ball, but just your best sense of this.
Yeah, I don't have, as you say, a crystal ball. But I think, you know, I don't know what we'll see in terms of whether there'll be an increase in ambition In what's called the INDC, your listeners may be familiar with that based on previous conversations about the climate negotiations and the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. But basically, Canada's national contribution to this new agreement is sort of inadequate in terms of what it should be putting forward from a global perspective. But you know, because of the intransigence of the Harper government on climate policy and actually implementing anything to reduce emissions, even that target's probably going to be difficult to reach. So I think we may see an increase in ambition in the commitment, but I think what'll be really important to see as well is an extraordinarily large increase in the sort of planning and sincerity of implementation of emissions reductions in Canada, whatever the target is. I think the other significant thing that's really interesting, considering that one of the first major international forums that Pierre Trudeau, the new prime minister, is going to be attending is going to be the G20 meeting. The leader summit, mm-hmm. which is coming up in mid-November just before the Paris negotiations, mm-hmm. is that part of their platform was a pledge to phase out fossil fuel subsidies, which has linkages to the climate conversation because subsidies drive greenhouse gas emissions, they drive climate change, and they're a huge waste of public money. So it'll be really interesting to see whether and on what timeline the new prime minister follows through on that promise as well.
This is all going to be really interesting. I mean, it really feels like this is a new day. I guess I hope it's a better day, but it really seems like a new day. Alex, do you guys have the same issues with climate denialists up there in Canada that we do down here? Does that play any part in the electorate? You know what I'm saying? Have your people fallen for it the way so many have fallen for it down here, for that hoax?
No, I mean, there are sitting members of parliament who've cast doubt on anthropogenic climate change and the scientific consensus. They're sort of on the wrong side of the science, but they're not really taken seriously. Most of them are relegated to the back benches, and Canadians just turfed out the party that shelters those deniers.
Good.
Or those lukewarmers. So I think it is a new day. I think there's going to have to be a lot of pressure still on Canada to really get them to step up toward Paris. But I think, we can move away, hopefully, from the blame Canada mode into something more constructive now that we have a new government.
Yeah, but it's such a good song. I hate to give it up entirely. Alex Dukas, so helpful, so clarifying, and I believe we are on the verge of a new day, and it's going to be really interesting to watch and see what happens next. You've really helped us make sense of it, helped me, a guy from the U.S. who has no idea where Canada is until I looked at it on the map just before this interview. So thanks so much for this for the help, Alex, and let's try to do it again in the future. Alex Dukas from Oil Change International. Get more information on him and his work at priceofoil.org. You can also follow them on the Twitters at priceofoil. And you can follow Alex on the Twitters at A Dukas. That's A-D-O-U-K-A-S on the Twitters. Oh, and finally, don't forget to stop by climatewelcome.ca and give Justin Trudeau the welcome that he deserves. Alex, great speaking with you, sir.
Great. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
You bet. We'll do it again soon. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more broadcast right after this.
Even a real country anyway.
No, they're not. And we won't stop playing that song just because we like Canada again. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. My thanks again to Alex Dukas of Oil Change International. He mentioned, by the way, while we were off the air, that while he had pointed us to climatewelcome.ca as a Canada action, he said for an international action, day of international action on November 14th, we can all look forward to stopfundingfossils.org. So if you want to check that out, please do. And maybe we'll have Alex back November 14th is the big day for Stop Funding Fossils. So maybe we'll have him back to talk about that when we get a little bit closer. He was fantastic.
Yeah, that was really informative. I think I've learned more about Canada in just those 30 minutes than I've learned in my entire life.
I was going to say, even though he's Canadian, he was still fantastic. I rather enjoyed it. All right. Okay, back to this country and our crappier politics, our way crappier politics. Speaking of crappy, Jim Webb, the former one-term Virginia senator and now Democratic nominee, or not anymore Democratic candidate, I should say, and no longer a Democratic candidate for the 2016 nomination, because he dropped out of the race. Here were some comments of his this morning as he said goodbye to all of this.
The very nature of our democracy is under siege due to the power structure and the money that finances both political parties. Its Americans don't like the extremes to which both parties have moved in recent years, and quite frankly, neither do I. I fully accept that my views on many issues are not compatible with the power structure and the nominating base of the Democratic Party. That party is filled with millions of dedicated, hardworking Americans, but its hierarchy is not comfortable with many of the policies that I have laid forth, and frankly, I'm not that comfortable with many of theirs. For this reason, I'm withdrawing from any consideration of being the Democratic Party's nominee for the presidency.
That was, once again, a former one-term Virginia Senator Jim Webb dropping out of the race for the Democratic nomination. Jim Webb had been a Republican years ago. He turned to a Democrat, and he probably would have won in Virginia had he decided to continue running, but he decided to quit. He went on to say, and actually, let me just say, he's half right in that statement. Yes, the power and money structure is absolutely obscene in both parties. But talking about both parties moving to the extreme is just ridiculous. It's something a Republican might say, which reminds us why Jim Webb dropped out, why he found no support in the Democratic race. And it wasn't because of, the parties have moved to some extreme. It's because Jim Webb is almost more Republican than he is Democrat. As a matter of fact, he's talking about thinking about a third party bid, an independent bid. I think he should think about getting into the Republican race. I think he would do great. I think he would be really welcome over there. I think there's a lot of people who would like a non-insane candidate, and I think Jim Webb is not insane. They would like a non-insane conservative candidate, and that's what Jim Webb is. He went on to say during his press conference today, that he continues to toy with the idea of launching a third-party bid for the White House, according to The Hill, saying that he's receiving, quote, hundreds of letters urging him to do so. I don't know if hundreds is going to get him the job, but he says, quote, I know the histories of independent candidates. They tend to top out around 20% historically, but because of the paralysis between our two parties, there is a time an independent candidacy actually could win. I believe he is correct. And by the way, I hope he does run as an independent candidate. I think that would be terrific. I say the more the merrier. The Hill goes on to report that over the last few months since declaring his bid for president, Webb has held barely any campaign events in early primary states, and his poll numbers have hovered in the low single digits. I might suggest that's another reason why he wasn't doing well. He wasn't campaigning very hard. He didn't seem to be trying very hard until he got to the Democratic debate last week and complained that he wasn't getting any time on stage. The Hill goes on to report that the man who quit Congress after one term insisted that if he ran as an independent candidate, he would pose a threat to the two major parties and their candidates, even boasting he could beat Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in a general election. Well, good luck with that, sir. Somebody could beat them. I don't know that it's Jim Webb. He said more people in this country call themselves independents than Republicans or Democrats, and I agree, he said. We are more than a label. Americans are disgusted right now that Republicans and Democrats call each other the enemy instead of reaching across the table to work together. That's complete and utter nonsense, Senator. I mean, if anything, the Democrats have been doing too much reaching across the table for too many years. And of course, Jim Webb should know that. He was in the Senate for many of those years where Democrats gave up everything in trying fruitlessly to work with Republicans. He went on to say, Americans don't like the extremes to which both parties have moved, and I don't either. Extremes? Really? Really, Senator? Yes, the Republican Party has moved to an extreme. But man, I just hate that false equivalence stuff that, you know, the media does, and apparently guys like Senator Jim Webb.
Well, yeah, if he's going to talk about the political paralysis and how much, you know, regular Americans hate that, then it would help him to acknowledge that really it's coming from the Republican Party in Congress. To not acknowledge that is to not acknowledge reality, and I think most Americans understand that, and that's why he didn't get traction.
And it's not only to not only acknowledge reality, it also perpetuates the status quo.
True.
It says, you know, it says that, oh, both sides do it. Nobody needs to change. Well, I mean, it says everybody needs to change. But we all know that's not true. At least, you know, half of the two major parties need to change in a big, big way if they are ever to be relevant again and make anything but paralysis happen here. And this is not to say that the Democrats are any good, but to imagine falsely, ridiculously, absurdly that the Democratic Party has moved to some kind of an extreme is ridiculous. I would love to see them move to an extreme. And, you know, they're inching somewhat to the left. But frankly, you know, no thanks to guys like Jim Webb. All right. I got to get to this because I've been trying to get to this for a while. We talked about a lot of the voter suppression that was going on around the country, again, by Republicans. And I'll be happy to point out Democrats if and when they do it. But it's all Republicans right now that are doing the voter suppression in this country. Oh, and apparently up in Canada, according to Alex Dukas. But in any event, this Kris Kobach, we have talked about him a lot on this show. Unfortunately, we have to continue talking about him because what the Kris Kobach, Secretary of State of Kansas, is doing out there is just remarkable and getting remarkabler over time. Michael A. Smith, associate professor of political science at Emporia State University, writes in the Salina Journal, question, when is 3 greater than 37,000? Answer, now, in the Kansas Secretary of State's office. Since Kris Kobach has begun using his new power to prosecute voter fraud, Kobach's numbers problem is vast. Recently, he writes, and ostensibly to curb this voting fraud crisis, Kobach approved an administrative rule that will purge about 37,000 suspense voters from the state's voting rolls. These are the voters who did not show proof of American citizenship, such as birth certificate, when they registered, nor within 90 days afterwards. So this was a new law that was put in place in 2013, requiring only new voters, by the way. If you're already registered to vote in Kansas, you're in. Nothing to worry about. It's only those pesky new voters who now have to show some proof of citizenship, whether they own it or not, whether they have to go out and you know, buy a passport or a birth certificate. This has resulted in some 37,000 voters who are no longer allowed to vote in state elections. Now, the Supreme Court has decided, yes, they can vote in federal elections, but not in state elections. But Kris Kobach is going to stop that. He's not even going to let them vote in federal elections, because what he's claiming is that, well, they have not finished the state process for registering to vote. And if they haven't done so now within 90 days, he wants to throw them off the rolls. Michael Smith goes on to say that since a policy's benefits should exceed its costs, observers are looking at more than 37,000 documented cases of voter fraud to justify this purge. But Kobach has provided just 3. That's right. There are 3 cases of voter fraud that Kris Kobach, who ran 5 years ago now for Secretary of State of Kansas on the basis that he was there to stop a voter fraud epidemic from going on, just 3 cases he has been able to bring forward recently now that he has been granted prosecutorial power that no other Secretary of State in the country has. He has been given this by the Republican legislature in Kansas, by the Republican governor, the power to prosecute. Now, normally, if a Secretary of State found evidence of election fraud of any type, whether it's insider election fraud or voter fraud, they would refer that to a prosecutor, either a federal prosecutor or a state district attorney or a county district attorney. But in this case, he wanted that power for himself because any referrals he made, people looked at it, the prosecutors looked at it and said, no, this is not a case worth bringing a prosecution for. So he says he has found three cases of voter fraud that he has filed charges for. He says that he has evidence of 237 other cases that occurred between 1997 and 2011. Got that? So out of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of votes cast in the state of Kansas, Kris Kobach has come up with a total of, if all of them are found guilty, 237 cases of illegal voting between 1997 and 2011. Now, mind you, these 37,000 voters that he is hoping to purge have registered just since the 2012 election. So 37,000 voters he wants to get rid of because of 237 cases of voter fraud that he contends are voter fraud, and they're actually not, and I'll tell you about that in a second. At least not the type of voter fraud that he is claiming. So this would come to, 0.7% in an absolute worst case scenario, 0.7% of illegal voting cases. Actually, no, my numbers are wrong. It's even lower than that. This is just a tiny fraction of the number of votes total since 2012. He goes back to 1997 and says there are 237 cases total of voter fraud that he hopes to bring forward. And guess what? Every single one of those cases has nothing to do with citizenship, has only to do with double voting. People who voted in Kansas and in another state, allegedly. None of them so far have anything to do with being non-citizens. And that would be the only reason to require proof of citizenship. Now, he says he needs to do this because even though there's not many, 237, but we have very close races in Kansas. We have races that are decided by three or five votes. That's right. You do. And yet, you're willing to toss 37,000 people off the rolls for no reason at all. Now, the three cases of three charges of voter fraud that he's brought have been brought against one guy and one couple. The guy admits that he voted in two separate states, but he thought he was allowed to. He actually has property, he says, in Yuma County, Colorado, as well as Sherman County, Kansas. He said, when I look at a Colorado voter registration form, I'm signing a Colorado form. It doesn't say it's a United States form. It says Colorado form. In Kansas, my reasoning was the same. He said, I know for a fact that I only voted for one president one time. The issues in Kansas that I vote for would have been for that general election, such as property tax. And if I voted for a senator or representative in the state of Kansas, this would have nothing to do with a senator or a representative in the state of Colorado. Now, he's absolutely wrong on the law. If he voted twice in the same election, that is illegal and he should be held accountable, even if he didn't understand the law. But clearly he did not understand the law. Same thing with this couple who apparently voted in both Kansas and Arkansas, though it's not clear that they actually lived in both places at the same time. The indictments have very few details. It may be that they lived in Kansas during the primary and then they moved to Arkansas and voted in that general election. We don't know. But again, none of it has anything to do with citizens voting, with non-citizens voting. It all has to do with double voting, which this proof of citizenship would do nothing about. Nor would the photo ID restrictions that Kris Kobach has put in place for the polling place, they wouldn't have stopped this type of voting either. For example, if you vote by absentee in Colorado and then you show up at the polls with a photo ID or without a photo ID, it's not going to stop that double voting. This is going on in the light of day in Kansas. I know we're going to talk about this more because what Kris Kobach is doing is absolutely outrageous, but the Republican Party is now looking to Kris Kobach for methods and ideas and schemes to keep largely Democratic voters from being able to cast their vote. And by the way, those three indictments that Kris Kobach, with his new prosecutorial powers, has brought, they were all against Republicans. What? I thought it was a Democratic voter fraud epidemic that they had warned us about. Apparently not. Man, all right. We will have more on this in the days and months and years, I suspect, ahead. Take a quick break, and we are back with our Sea Change Green News Report. Lots of good news in the Green News Report. Right after this, I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Melting for you here on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman from bradblog.com here with Desi Doyen. Boy, just a big day overall, but every single story in our Green News Report coming up momentarily is huge.
I know. It's awesome. I love it.
We recorded this prior to our conversation moments ago with Alex Dukas. So in regard to Canada, I'll refer you back to our earlier segment. Even though we talk about what happened in Canada last night on our latest Green News Report.
We now know there will be no more drilling in the Arctic during the Obama presidency. This one's done.
Obama administration shuts down Arctic oil drilling.
This is beyond hypocrisy. I'm not even sure what to call it.
Accountability may be coming for Exxon's climate deception.
The time, I think, has come to move to a new generation of technology.
Big changes ahead for the auto industry. Plus, conservatives out, liberals in Canada. So what about that whole Keystone XL pipeline thing?
Yeah, what about it? All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We'll be fine with the environment. We can leave a little bit, but you can't destroy businesses.
Okay, well, thank you for leaving a little bit of the environment, Donald Trump. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, a lot of, frankly, really huge stories today. We have just learned that the Liberals have taken over the Canadian government, throwing out the Conservative Party and Prime Minister Stephen Harper. This could have a huge effect on the Keystone XL pipeline and the Energy East pipeline, both controversial and set to ship dirty tar sands oil from Alberta all over the place. I guess it remains to be seen now what will happen with the new Liberal government in charge up in Canada.
Yeah, we should hopefully have more on that in our next episode, but it very possibly could put an end to the nearly 10-year pro-oil agenda of the Harper administration.
Yes, underline the word possibly, given that just days ago, the co-chair for the Justin Trudeau campaign, he's the head of the Liberals, had to resign because of his ties to TransCanada and the oil industry. So a lot of questions, but an encouraging sign, perhaps, at least that Harper is gone. All right. What other earth-shaking news do you have for us today, Desi Doyen?
Well, accountability may be coming for Exxon. We've been telling you about the blockbuster investigation revealing that Exxon executives knew about the dangers of burning fossil fuels in causing global warming as early as 1977, but Exxon copied the tobacco industry and spent millions of dollars funding front groups to deceive deceive the public and policymakers about the scientific evidence. Now, Congressman Ted Lieu and Mark DeSaulnier, both Democrats from California, have asked the U.S. Justice Department to investigate Exxon in the same way the Justice Department investigated and successfully convicted Big Tobacco on racketeering charges 10 years ago for conspiring to deceive the public. Congressman Lieu explained on the broadcast that it isn't just that Exxon remained silent on what they knew.
They were taking affirmative steps both in what they said, who they funded, and actions they took to push back against climate change science. And keep in mind, they internally took actions to take advantage of global warming. So this is beyond hypocrisy. I'm not even sure what to call it.
What the congressman was referring to there was the fact that not only did Exxon know, but they tried to take advantage of the fact that the Arctic would be melting, and hey, makes it easier to drill up there in the Arctic without all of that ice.
Speaking of the Arctic, another setback for big oil in the Arctic. On Friday, the Interior Department announced that it has halted all auctions of leases to drill for oil and gas in the U.S. waters off the coast of Alaska due to the lack of interest from the oil industry due to slumping global oil prices. Interior Department also announced it will not renew or extend any existing leases in the Arctic, and that includes leases held by Shell Oil, which abandoned its efforts in the Arctic last month after getting disappointing results.
And after getting approval from the Obama administration to do it in the first place, I am glad they have flip-flopped now, so to speak. So good for them. About time.
Meanwhile, a big shift underway in the auto industry. After automaker Volkswagen was caught red-handed cheating on U.S. emissions tests, Tesla CEO Elon Musk suggested this may signal the end of the internal combustion engine.
What the Volkswagen is really showing is that we've reached the limit of what's possible with diesel and gasoline.
It appears Volkswagen agrees. VW executives have announced, quote, the future is electric, and in a statement they say they will now focus their product range and core technologies on building long-range, all-electric and plug-in hybrid cars across all of their brands. And it's not just Volkswagen. Swedish automaker Volvo is also going electric, saying, quote, we believe the time has come for electric vehicles. Volvo announced it will offer plug-ins or hybrid versions of every model it sells within 4 years.
And that comes on the heels of BMW saying that every single car they make will be electric in some form or another over the next 10 years.
Plus, Japanese automaker Toyota says it will make virtually all gasoline engines from its product line extinct by 2050, focusing on hybrids and electrics and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles.
Nothing but good news today. For more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Changes. Turn and face the strange. Changes. Don't want to be a richer man. Changes.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, for all of that good news in a row. It's so unlike you.
Do my best.
Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn. Also to my guest today, Alex Dukas of Oil Change International. Get more information at priceofoil.org. If you missed any portion of today's program, go download it at bradblog.com or over at iTunes, where we hope you will give us a good review. We deserve it. Also, you can drop me email anytime. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. Find me and follow me on the Twitters at TheBradBlog. All right, I think that's it. Until we see you next time, my thanks to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.